my fellow Discerner Billions, we've already looked at one of the nicest, richest, fanciest electorates here in Melbourne, the electorate of Goldstein, which takes in beautiful suburbs like Brighton on the Bay there. Famous influencers and stars live there. But today we're going to be visiting Sydney, my old stomping ground, to their most nicest, beautiful electorate of Wentworth. Wentworth takes in lovely suburbs I used to live in. Oh, I miss it. Vaucluse, Point Piper, Edgecliff, Double Bay, Paddington, Woollahra, all those lovely places used to be held by Malcolm Turnbull, everyone's favourite Prime Minister, I'm told. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Lukovits. Lukovits is known as affectionately as Luco. He is quite prolific on social media and he is running for the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, who you will know of because of Campbell Newman and David Limbrick and so on, fighting for the freedoms of people everywhere. Today, we're going to have a chat about what's going on Wentworth. I have no idea why he's running in that seat when it's just a full-on crazy climate change seat. But let's have a chat about what's going to happen in Wentworth and around the country as a whole. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thanks, Matt. It's really nice to actually be able to do this with you because you and I have followed each other for a while on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn was probably the most sort of gun-shy conservative, of all the sort of social media platforms. A, because, you know, it wasn't anonymous, and B, because it was all sort of very business-oriented and people didn't like, you know, saying what they actually think. Mm-hmm. And you and I started following each other because I'd post something that was probably common sense, but, you know, by LinkedIn standards was considered sort of quite edgy and, you know, you'd click like and vice versa. And, you know, I used to have people who would come up to me at trade shows or security industry things and they'd go, oh man, you know, I love what you're posting on LinkedIn. And I said, I didn't even know you looked at it. You've never clicked like, you've never done anything. And it's because people thought that for the mere act of clicking like, you know, they would get cancelled and, you know, lose their job and end up sleeping in the car. So I feel like you and I are the sort of cutting edge Joe Rogans of LinkedIn, and saying that out loud, it sounds really cringe, doesn't it?
No, but you're correct, Luca, because I have been told off. Someone messaged me and said, hey, I saw you liked this post by someone. You shouldn't be liking that sort of post.
Why? I mean, honestly, why? You know, I have no problem going back to the way things once were, when it was absolutely accepted that there were three things you never discussed at work. And they were religion, politics, and sport. Or at least, what? You know, well, when I was in the room, don't talk to me about sport, right? But, you know, some people say that's politics. But now, every business is expected to get on top of, you know, trendy politics and, you know, woke causes and social justice. And so, you know, you have as part of, you know, some sort of progressive desire, companies getting on top of that. And yet, curiously, they never actually weigh in on politics that affects business. So you'll never get a business coming out on LinkedIn and smashing payroll tax or smashing our ridiculous system of award wages in this country or smashing, you know, policies that could lead to carbon tax and bad energy. You know, they never want to talk about that. So that's politics which affects business, but is apparently something business never talks about. So instead, they're talking about completely non-objectionable things like, you know, I don't know, American Express, for example, will post a thing saying, you know, we abhor anti-Asian racism, and it will get a million likes. But what reasonable person doesn't do that? It's such safe bravery for these people to all sort of climb on the bandwagon and say something really safe like, you know, down with racism or down with murder. It's like, well, thank you for making a difference in the world. So I feel like you and I are so edgy just by saying really simple things like hire people because they're talented and not because of some other attribute they have. And everyone agrees, but people are terrified to agree out loud. So only the prevailing view gets heard. And it's not even cancel culture. I don't think anybody's been punished for saying things or clicking likes. I mean, okay, yeah, sure, we all get banned from time to time. And you know, but if you haven't been banned from social media, we find a way back on. Yeah. But it's this prior restraint that people exhibit where they don't even want to say things because they're so terrified of some, you know, boogie person who's out there that, you know, could cause them grief. And it's a shame because we're just not talking anymore. And that's why I love what you're doing. And I'm really glad to be here. And how's that for an intro?
What an intro. Thank you for the praise. Hey, so we should start with what you just described. That's the Soviet Union wrapped up. That's Solzhenitsyn talked about people. What do they say? I can't remember how he said it, but basically in public they supported, but in private they were critics of the government. Before we go on, we should outline that you know, you've got a pretty strong corporate background. You're the CEO of Calamity, and I'm told you're one of the foremost experts in the country on security, not just cybersecurity, but physical security and terrorism and all this kind of stuff. So I'd love to hear from you before we get into politics. What's the go in the corporate world? We just talked about how they're taking the cheap virtue kind of wins that they can, where it doesn't cost them anything. Why are they doing that? And more importantly, I don't understand why they do it to their own detriment. Why doesn't the Business Council come out and slam Labor when they do something dodgy? And why don't they slam Liberal? Like, they're just like pussyfooting around all the time. I don't get it.
Well, I mean, we'll get to my background in a minute, but I mean, the Business Council is an interesting one because my opponent in Wentworth, Allegra Spender, will frequently say, well, the Business Council has said the following. And I mean, it's almost a drinking game. Every time she brings up the Business Council, everybody takes a drink. You'll be hammered by the end of the debate. And, you know, I'd never really heard of the Business Council brought up that often. You know, maybe I was just hanging around the wrong bars or something. And I went and looked up who's on the Business Council. And, you know, the smallest business that would be there would probably be, you know, maybe Qantas or one of the banks. Like, these are major, major organizations. And, you know, one thing those organizations are very good at is finding dollars. And so I don't think they all, you know, sit around saying, oh, this is how we're going to save the world. They're looking at the numbers and they're deciding how to make a go of it. You know who's not on the Business Council? Are businesses like mine, businesses like yours, you know, small businesses. And they really, you know, without sounding, I suppose, like a, you know, a Liberal Party ad, they really are the backbone of our economy. And, you know, they're getting shafted. So, you know, why they don't get on top of those things? Look, I think it's probably because being on boards now, you know, and getting involved in those areas, for a lot of people, it's a bit like being the school captain. It looks really good on the resume, but there's someone else who's actually doing a lot of the work. And so what happens is, once you get to a certain level and you get a taste of that and you want to get your next board appointment, or you want to get an invitation to the chairman's lounge at Qantas, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, there's a certain thing, you know, you're expected to say, whether it's about, you know, the latest sort of woke virtue signaling cause, or whether it's, you know, climate policies or employment policies, or, you know, all the trendy stuff that really has nothing to do with the central function of a business, which is to make money. So they keep saying that and saying that. And so they go from board to board to cocktail party to cocktail party. But it's ordinary Australians who are constantly the ones paying for this. And I think that's a real problem, because especially when those people then not only have either direct ownership of the communications channels, you know, your Facebooks and so forth, or they have so much money that they are the loudest voice in the room, and that drowns out all the quieter voices. Or for people who don't have an opinion, they just hear the loudest voice and assume that's what they're supposed to believe. And I think that's really dangerous for our democracy and for us as a society.
Yeah, okay. We've got a problem here, though. We've got an Overton window shift and a cultural slide. If you think of the left and the right, which I don't really believe in anymore, it's more like authoritarian versus freedom. But anyway, left and right, if you look at the left, say the AOC types, just the loud, the green, the Allegra Spenders, the Zoe Daniels down here, the what's the lady who defeated Tony Abbott
in the Zali Stegall.
The green left get up loud and they drag the debate to the left. The conservatives on the other end are just weak. And when they go with a policy, they just can't handle any accusation or any fire from journalists at all. And they just fold. And so over time, you're seeing this shift left as the right wing surrenders ground.
Well, I think one of the other problems is that, you know, we're not getting a certain type of character entering politics. I mean, if you look at some of the greatest leaders, I mean, in Australia, for example, you know, Bob Hawke, in America, JFK, for example. Now, these were pants men, right? You know, they drank, they womanized, you know, they swore. They were everything that would probably see someone get cancelled today. You know, Bob Hawke could not exist today. He would be cancelled. Yeah. And so what does that mean? It means that the people who are going into politics are so restrained and so, pun intended, politically correct, that they actually lose the ability to say what they think. And I believe that's really important. I mean, I have no problem at all saying, this is my opinion on something. I mean, you know, ask me whatever you want and I'll give you my opinion. Now, you can take it or leave it, but at least you know what it is. Unfortunately, we have a lot of career politicians. And if you've spent, you know, 11 years, you know, you started as a party staffer or maybe a union member or something, and then you found your way eventually up the rank, and then finally you get to the backbench. You know, you've waited 10 years for that job that comes with the car and the office and the people greeting you when you walk down the street. You're not going to do anything to jeopardize that by, you know, saying something as controversial as what, you know, Catherine Deaves might have said, you know, men shouldn't be involved in women's sport. And this is like such a shocking thing. But the funny thing is, there's a whole quiet mass of people out there who are waiting to hear that. And as much as the left, you know, wailed and gnashed their teeth over Donald Trump, they created Donald Trump because characters like that are the sort of natural reaction to people who are just mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. And the one place where you can really speak your mind is in the privacy of a polling booth. And so, you know, you can say whatever you want to people who ring you up for polls, and people will always say, you know, exactly what they think the person wants to hear. But in the polling booth, no one needs to know what you think.
Well, this is probably why the UAP, Clive Palmer's party, is going to get more votes than they probably should, because people are just going to retaliate with a protest vote. But hey, can I ask you about actual politics then? We're looking at your seat of Wentworth, where people don't realize it was Malcolm Turnbull's. I used to chat and say hi. I had a business there in Edgecliff, and he'd always be at Gloria Jeans across the road. And he was a nice enough gentleman, and we exchanged some emails and so on. But then I saw that was before he slid towards being super green. Then he became this big greenie, and he was actually outfoxed by an even bigger greener, Dr. Karen Feltz. It took the by-election. I think, yeah, she won the by-election when he left. And then now it's won back by Dave Sharma, right? So I don't understand why you're running for Wentworth when it's the most blue ribbon seat. If there's any threat to a blue ribbon seat holder there, it's from the green left. So what are you doing coming from, whether you call it the right or the freedom parties? What are you doing?
Well, I suppose let me come back to your early question and tell you a bit about my business, because you know that ties into it. So I'm in the security and life safety business, and my company, Calamity, we have people who sit 24/7 and they keep people safe. And it's something that I've pretty much done my entire professional life, and that's keep people safe. And you know, when I'm sort of talking to law enforcement types, we use an analogy of you've got your wolves, who are the baddies that are out to hurt people, and you've got the sheep, and that's most of, you know, that's most of the population who just sort of want to go about their life, and the sheep are oblivious to the wolves. And in the middle, you've got the sheepdogs, and the sheepdogs are, you know, the military, the law enforcement, you know, emergency services, the people who actually keep us safe, you know, and they're not politically correct, and they're sweary, and you know, there's often, you know, masculinity and all these sort of things, but that's what keeps us safe. And, you know, I've always sort of fit into the sheepdog mold. I'm very, very, you know, focused on my integrity, on honesty, on, you know, doing the right thing. It's something that, you know, I impress all the time on my staff in what's actually a really, really dodgy, dirty industry. You know, and I mean, it's cost us. My company would probably be worth $30, $40 million like some others, you know, if I just didn't do the right thing, like, you know, paying wages properly and managing tax properly. And so as a business owner, I've watched in disbelief for so many years as people who did the wrong thing would go laughing all the way to the bank, and people who did the right thing would go broke. You know, and it frustrated the heck out of me. But like so many other things in this country, you know, we put up with it because the weather's good, the quality of living is excellent. You know, we've only ever known peacetime.
So, you know, we put up with it, and sure, you know, occasionally we have a gripe in the letters to the editor, and, you know, every 3 years we march down to the local primary school and you know, we sort of vote for more of the same, and nothing really changes. The last few years, though, everything changed. I watched what happened in the pandemic, and I watched it as a member of our society. I watched it as a father. I watched it as a business owner. I watched it as a risk professional. And under every single category, I wasn't happy with what transpired. As a risk professional, I saw us trying to adopt a zero risk approach. So, for example, you know, we're going to have zero COVID. And anybody who knows anything about risk, anything at all, will know that you can't eliminate risk. All you can do is you can manage it. And at no point did I ever hear a politician stand up and say, a lot of people are going to die, this is going to be really bad, but we're all going to get through this together. Didn't hear that. We had daily press conferences that really didn't say much at all. We had an entire society that's been whipped into a panic. We had lockdowns, which we now know were unnecessary, and the costs of which may never be fully realized. And the thing that really saddened me the most was that the people who were responsible for all of these decisions lost nothing. Whereas, you know, every single day I was getting, you know, a phone call from someone else who had to cancel our service because they'd just lost their business, they'd lost everything. And, you know, Menzies spoke about the forgotten people. And this country has a lot of forgotten people, a lot. And they're not the ones on Twitter. And they're not the ones who can afford to fund a political campaign. And, you know, they're not the ones who are out marching in the streets. They're the ones who are just getting by, and they keep getting pushed down. And it was like a macro version of what I'd seen in the industry for a few years. Now, I run a business. And a few years ago, if you said to me, you know, would you go into politics? I'd say you need your head read. I mean, why would anybody in business want to take a pay cut, want to move to Canada? You know, want to have complete strangers on social media, you know, call you nasty things. And that's the problem. Because of that, we don't get competent, smart people with great leadership qualities going into those positions. We just get, you know, the next person up the ladder kind of falling into the spot. And, you know, I mean, I heard, for example, you know, Allegra Spender was the third person that they went to because there were another couple of picks, you know, ahead of her who were probably sensible enough to say, you know what, I've got my millions and my house and my life, and I don't need that, you know, in my life. And so round and round and round and round this goes. So why did I do it in Wentworth? Well, look, I know what my chances are in Wentworth. I mean, you know, to even be a contender, you probably need $1 million in the war chest. And I don't have that. You know, I don't have billionaires looking to fund me so that they can, you know, improve their share portfolio. I don't have huge business throwing money at me just to sort of buy the favor one day when they pick up the phone and ring the local MP. And, you know, that's not any one party that does that. I mean, I've spoken to very wealthy people who told me that they give huge amounts of money to the Liberal Party every year, and they give huge amounts to the Labor Party. So they're sort of having a bet each way. And yet they will also then tell me how terrible everything is, but they keep sort of rewarding bad behavior. So I thought, all right, you know what? I don't need to necessarily be successful in going to politics. I can go into politics and I can make a difference. And that's what I try to do every day when I go to the office. I try to make a difference. That's what I do when I talk to other people. That's what I do with my kids. That's what I do with, you know, other people's kids when, you know, when I'm talking to them. It's really about making a difference. And, you know, whether I win or whether I lose, I know I can make a difference. A, because I want to put a few things on the agenda. Nuclear energy is one. If I can get this country talking about nuclear energy, then, you know, I've already achieved something.
Can we show a, as you're talking, we'll just show a corporate sign you put up about nuclear, quite cheeky.
Anyway, yeah, so this was great. Let me explain what you're looking at now. This was this is a sign that Waverley Council have had on that pole probably for 20 odd years. And, you know, I thought it was stupid. So I've called them out for it. And it got so much attention for, you know, a few reasons. I mean, the first one being because it's probably the first time in Australian political history there's been a core flute that was funny. So, yeah. You know, even if I get smashed in this election, if you ever see a funny core flute ever again in a political campaign, I started that. So that's kind of cool. But it also got people thinking about just the ridiculous, you know, indulgent sort of taxpayer money wasting things that every layer of government do. You know, there was another one, and we'll pop that up on the screen now, where I called out these say no to racism signs that were popping up around council areas. I mean, besides the fact that this costs money and it's just virtue signaling, I can't imagine a single person that was, I was going to go out and I was going to belt some black people today, but then I saw that sign. So, yeah, I saw the sign. So I'm not going to do it. I mean, you know, my office is in South Sydney and I see this at the shopping center all the time. Like when no one's buying ads on the billboard, they show sort of community service messages. Yeah. There's things like, bashing women is never okay. And I mean, look, it's impossible to disagree with that, but I'm looking at it and thinking, has anybody actually ever studied, you know, whether this sort of stuff has the slightest impact or it's just a feel-good measure? Because, you know, if you've ever traveled around communist countries, and I have, the one thing that you notice there is they have all of these signs telling people how to behave. I mean, they have mastered social engineering. Now, you know, you've never seen a sign on an Australian street that says no spitting, but there are some countries, you know, where you'll see that because they need to be told so that way, you know, they can be punished for non-conformance. And I'm starting to see a lot more of that here. I went to the so-called Melbourne International Comedy Festival a few weeks ago, and at one of the theatres, they had a sign there that was basically telling theatre goers, please don't talk during the performance. And I'm just thinking, A, what has happened to our society that a sign like that is needed in the first place? But B, does anybody think that that sign is going to magically make an asshole be less of an asshole?
Actually, no. You know what it does, Luco, and we've observed this in COVID lockdown season. It doesn't stop them. It empowers the little Karens, and it says it empowers them to go, "Oi, oi! You're not allowed to do that because look at the sign."
Right, so you've got the little sign monitors now attending comedy theatres there. Well, that's great because, you know, it starts there and it ends with Hannah Gadsby and you end up going to a comedy show where, you know, people don't laugh, they applaud. And, wow, that's a really bleak dystopian future, isn't it?
Hey, so let's get down to actual numbers. What are you going to be able to do in Wentworth? I imagine not much. It's going to be stay blue or go a bit green.
Look, I mean, good call. There's interesting ways of looking at the polls there. I mean, I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, who do you think's going to win? And I never say myself. I'm too humble for that. But, you know, a lot of people thought, well, Allegra Spender is going to win because they see her core flutes everywhere. And I don't think that's a good metric because, first of all, you know, those things cost $20-$30 each installed, and there's never been a campaign that's had that sort of budget to spend on it. I also think that a lot of the people who are hanging those core flutes on the front of their house, and can I just say, I don't even have my own core flute on the front of my house, so I'm sort of questioning who are the people that do this? What's their problem? But anyway, I think a lot of those people are probably traditional Labor Green voters who've, you know, never ever got any satisfaction in Wentworth and now sort of see this as their chance. I mean, Labor and the Greens are running dead in that seat. The Labor MP, Tim Murray. Yeah, look, he's a nice guy. He's on Waverley Council. I don't think he's in it to win it. So I don't know that necessarily it's captured a lot of, you know, rusted on Liberal voters, even though I think there was this idea that, you know, teal is kind of Liberal blue with a splash of green. I don't think people are buying that. And the other thing that I noticed is that although, you know, yes, you do see her face in all of these doorways, it's the doorways where you don't see anything that I think, you know, are the interesting ones. Because, I mean, just because of visual pollution, you're going to notice the face everywhere, but you're not going to notice all of the other houses that doesn't. Although there was one that I did notice, which is the Bianca Spender shop in Double Bay. So that's Allegra Spender's sister's fashion shop. Is one of the shops that doesn't actually have her sister's poster in the window. So, look, I don't know. You know, families are complicated. I can't comment on that. But so I think, you know, attracting a whole lot of Green Labor voters doesn't necessarily get you over the line. I do know, because they're coming over to me, that there are an awful lot of traditional Liberal voters who feel very badly let down by the Liberal Party. And I did as well. I thought, you know, what was happening during COVID was the Liberal Party forgetting what liberalism actually meant. You know, we all became refuseniks. We weren't allowed to even leave this country. And no one in the Liberal Party at all said, you know, this is not okay. And that was not okay for me. So they're looking for somewhere to go. And, you know, the Lib Dems is an interesting one because it's not a conservative party, but it permits, you know, those sort of views in a very, you know, in a very safe fashion. So, you know, there are some people who are saying that, you know, the Lib Dems, or, you know, whatever, it'll have to be rebranded after the election because the Liberal Party has sued them, because apparently they're the only ones allowed to use the word liberal, even though they've forgotten what it means, could become, you know, the new Liberal Party. I mean, I'm really happy to be a part of it because I think it's got the potential to be a genuine third alternative in Australian politics. There are so many people who are so fed up with voting, you know, blue or red every single election, and they're looking for somewhere else to go. And, you know, the Greens is not it. And I think, you know, the Lib Dems could potentially be there, because it doesn't actually matter, you know, if you're from the left or if you're from the right. There's certain things there that should be really attractive, you know, to everyone, whether it's on, you know, free speech, or whether it's on, you know, drug reform, various other things. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there for everybody. So that could be really interesting. So I think some of the Liberal voters might put me, you know, as their first preference, but they might then, you know, give some of that to Dave Sharma. So they'll sort of, you know, want to have a bet each way.
So your immediate hope is to put in a solid third place, changing the culture slowly over time, giving a strong third option.
Exactly right. I mean, I see myself as an early investor, you know, in this party. I mean, even though the party has been around over 20 years, and of course it was only recently the Liberal Party decided that was a problem, in many respects it's got a real startup energy to it. You know, we're getting a lot of attention for people who are finding the party for the first time. We've got a lot of candidates, and you know, almost none of them are sort of career politicians. They're you know, they're business owners, they're parents, they're exactly the sort of people who you want representing you, rather than these, you know, almost caricature like politicians that we've always had, who, you know, will follow a party line and will only say the approved things and will sort of stand there, you know, nodding clumsily on camera, and you don't actually know, you know, what these people think. And okay, I mean, sure, you know, there's always the danger that, you know, they might make a rookie move and they might say something that will, you know, never be forgotten about because, you know, social media and all this. But they're entirely genuine people. I've never met a more passionate group. And they're a really cool bunch. I mean, you know, we go out, you know, one of the candidates will have a launch or something, and, you know, we'll all go out afterwards for a bite and a drink. And, you know, people will be sitting there and, you know, a few glasses of wine later, and, you know, we're having, you know, big debates over, you know, Rothbardian issues and liberalism and, you know, the Overton window, which you should probably explain because we mentioned it earlier, but I'm totally down with that and, you know, following it. And, you know, so it really is a party for thinkers. They're very intellectual. Look, maybe that's part of the reason historically they haven't been that successful, because they're almost just, you know, too smart. And the average voter who almost doesn't want to vote, they just want to be told, you know, do this. They think in soundbites, you know, stop the boats, or, you know, more jobs, or, you know, higher welfare, or, you know, whatever it is. And I think, you know, we have a lot more nuance. So you know, but I'm proud of that. I hope we don't necessarily sort of emulate the others by distilling everything down to, you know, a twee slogan that would fit on a core flute, because I think people really need to pay more attention to this stuff and they need to think about it. You know, if you vote the same way your whole life, which, you know, may well be exactly the way your parents voted their whole life, nothing's going to change in this country. Now, for the last 20 years, that hasn't mattered. It's an amazing country and it always has been. But if you take a view, you know, 10, 20 years going forward, we face some incredible strategic challenges. And these are not things that we're going to just be able to, you know, fix overnight. These things take 10, 20, 30 years to fix. And so we are already so far behind the start line. So voters need to be smart. And of course, meanwhile, people aren't having these intelligent conversations. I mean, special thanks to anybody who's still with us now, you know, half an hour into this, because, you know, a lot of people now, you know, they're scrolling through Instagram and, you know, politics is fought in the meme trenches or things that get distilled down to tweets, and people sort of, you know, argue in sentences or in slogans rather than engaging in any sort of critical thinking that lets them listen to another point of view, go, okay, you know what, I agree with that. Actually, that makes sense. No, I don't agree with this. That's how a marketplace of ideas should work. We don't have that. We have a shouting match. And I think that's very, very dangerous, because when you look at one of the oldest military strategies, it's divide and conquer. And we have been divided by external forces that want nothing better than for us to all be at each other's throat. And you can see that in America. America is divided and they are at each other's throat. So that's step one, divide. Step two is what comes next. And I don't want that for my kids.
Yeah. So let's talk about the people that are in there. I had a medical clinic in Edgecliff there for 10 years and we had thousands of patients from Wentworth. So we got quite intimate with the lives of these people. And I'm wondering what kind of reception you're getting from them. Because in my mind, I think about that show Lux Listings. Shout out to Gavin Rubinstein, the short guy on that show who's taking the world by storm. But he kind of sums up the attitude. They're not all high-flying, living in $30 million mansions like you see on the show. But there is definitely a difference. You know, I grew up in the west of Sydney and then I ended up living and working in Wentworth for so many years. I'm not sure they're ready to hear what this kind of stuff you're saying. They seem to be more kind of a protection instinct where they want to protect what they've got. So they would go for a Liberal Party that's just going to protect them. But what kind of response are you getting to this message from the type of demographic that we know lives in Wentworth?
I think it's very important not to draw generalizations about any electorate, because it's very easy to say that, you know, people in Western Sydney are this or people in Wentworth are that. But, you know, again, coming back to the forgotten people, you know, they're out there. I mean, there are people in Wentworth, for example, who were post-war migrants. The Jewish community has got a lot of them. They came here off the boat straight after the Second World War. They had no money the way, you know, migrants seldom did. And they bought what at the time was the cheapest real estate. And some of that was literally Sydney Harbour waterfront property, because at the time, Aussies didn't want to live there because they thought the Japanese were going to bomb the harbour. So you get this really cheap land in, you know, unpopular suburbs like Point Piper. Now, 50 years later, you know, there are people who still have those assets, but they're living, you know, hand to mouth the rest of the time. So it would be unfair to say, oh, you know, look at that person who lives in the eastern suburbs, you know, they're completely loaded. Because, you know, there could be people in Western Sydney who live in, you know, a McMansion or something. And, you know, there might be people in the eastern suburbs who sort of look down their nose at them. But those are people, you know, they've got multiple cars, they've got, you know, they've got fishing boats, they go out on the weekend, they have all these fantastic holidays. You know, the other thing is in the eastern suburbs, we also have, you know, we have a, you know, a migrant population. We have people who come through. We have, you know, we have a younger demographic. And, you know, these are not necessarily people who are, you know, who are rolling the dough. Now, is there a lot of old money there? Yeah, absolutely there is. But one of the things that I've found interesting is talking to some, you know, real old money pedigree, you know, Wentworth type people. who really actually aren't happy with where things have gone over the last, you know, 20, 30 years. You know, it's become angry, it's become congested. You know, and one of the things is because the cost of living is so significant that a lot of the time people, you know, they don't have a lot of sort of disposable income. You know, they haven't had a holiday or they're stressing out. You know, I mean, you see, you go to Bondi Beach and besides the fact that you're probably going to have to pay, you know, 12, 13, 14 bucks an hour just to park there for, you know, 1 hour before you come and get a $300 ticket or whatever it is, put on your thanks for playing. You can be sitting in the car, you've got your towel on, you know, you're just sort of plugging your phone in and someone will pull in behind you and start beeping the horn because they're in such a rush to get to the beach. And everybody just needs to calm down. We have become so angry and so frustrated. And so I think there's actually a lot of people in Wentworth that feel that way. You know, you have a lot of people who, I mean, even though by all accounts they're living in, you know, they're living the dream, they're wealthy, they own a home, their kids go to a private school, but you know, they're actually depressed and on antidepressants and miserable, and they end up, you know, getting divorced, and you know, there's a lot of that happening there. So it's difficult to sort of put everyone into one box. One phenomena that I do notice though is I think Wentworth does tend to have a lot of the guilty rich. And, you know, these are people who either, you know, through hard work or just luck, you know, are extremely wealthy. And rather than, you know, sharing that wealth through, you know, philanthropy or, you know, volunteering at a soup kitchen or volunteerism or helping people, I'm not saying they don't necessarily do that. Maybe they do, but a lot of them now kind of want to sort of assuage their guilt by, you know, saving the world and solving climate change. And it's, you know, what better way to prove your worth? You know, I mean, merely virtue signaling by not being racist, as, you know, we have our entire life, is not enough. Now you have to go, you know, one step better and save the world. But the problem that I have is that these people have these luxury beliefs. There was a great article about that I read the other day that allow them to sort of show, you know, their bona fides to everyone else and show everyone else what they're doing, but they don't understand the cost and the impact that that has on other people. And one point that I keep making is I can't support any political policy that means a person in Greater Sydney who's working three or four jobs just to put food on the table should see the cost of everything in their life go up just so that someone who's fabulously wealthy in another suburb can drive their daughter to private school in an electric car. You know, that's not fair. And once upon a time, there was this belief that, you know, billionaires didn't care about the poor. You know, it was let them eat cake, that sort of thing. But now we have policies where billionaires who are looking to make further billions are putting in policies that will actually hurt the poor. Renewable subsidies and all the money that goes to, you know, paying for, you know, wind farms and solar panels and subsidies on, you know, $150,000 cars and whatever, that's basically a tax on the poor because energy affects every single thing that they buy. And there's so much of this. And I think the people in Wentworth are really seriously out of touch of it because so many of them have never, you know, they've never driven further than Parramatta Road. They've never actually seen what it's like out there. It's, you know, like their idea of struggle is that their holiday home doesn't have a swimming pool. And a lot of those people, I think, need to get out of their bubble.
Yeah. So you're jumping 10 topics ahead, Iluko. Back to my question. The reason why I started by saying I've had a medical clinic there is because we would literally have a billionaire come in, hello, how are you? And we'd see them. And then the next patient would be someone on a healthcare card really struggling. So I'm not talking about the distinction between rich and poor. I'm talking about the attitude that's in Wentworth. And I'm really, I struggle to see how what I hold dear and what you hold dear, we're talking about freedoms and we're talking about common sense. Just like Lux listings, that show, that resonated with me a lot because that was often the attitude of even the poorer people in Wentworth. It was not really a concern about these more academic issues that you and I can talk about. And we started to talk about in this interview, they were more concerned about the corporeal and the things, the reality of climbing a ladder and trying to get ahead. And I'm just very confused by something near to my heart, which would be LDP policies, the ones I most resonate with, and this suburb of Wentworth. I see it as a massive clash, and I don't understand how you would get much support on those kind of things. You'd get better support talking about this stuff out west, right?
Sure. Well, look, it depends. I mean, I think vaccine mandates, for example, and I think forcing people to undergo medical procedure is obscene. Right. But I'm not running a big, vaccine-related campaign in Wentworth because, there are so many people who are vaccinated that, it's almost a non-issue. And similarly, I felt lockdowns were extremely punitive and completely over the top. But a lot of people in Wentworth weren't hugely affected by that because, their lockdown experience was, sitting on their laptop, tweeting out stay safe to everybody as they watched Netflix and decided what to order on food. Now, the thing is, the food that was then brought to their door was brought by someone who probably doesn't live in Wentworth and whose life absolutely is affected by those things. So, I'm happy to also talk about things that are potentially more relevant to that set. For example, our education policy. I mean, it's a very well-educated electorate, and I think a lot of the reason people in that electorate send their kids to private school is not necessarily because they're rolling in dough. I mean, I hate this sort of class warfare that suggests, everyone who sends their kids to private school is a rich, entitled toff, because, I was driving in an Uber, in the back of an Uber the other day, and he was an Iranian migrant. And so, we started talking Middle East politics, as you do. And, I asked him where his kids went to school, and he said he goes to a private school. And this guy works 3 jobs just to send his kids there, because he knows that education and then the property market is their way out of, wherever they're living. So, I think people in Wentworth probably get that. So I'm happy to talk about the Lib Dems' education policy, which is, a game changer in this country. Whereas what every other political party are doing is saying, well, we're going to throw, more billions at the problem. And they keep looking at the sort of inputs, which is essentially, more subsidies, more money, more funding, more, bureaucrats. But they don't look at the output. And, as a business owner, I'm very results oriented. And if something doesn't work, you just stop it. But because we have politicians who are so terrified of saying, well, you know what, that was a giant stuff up, so let's scrap that. That's something you never hear politicians do, because they know that a year later, there's going to be a campaign that plays back that video saying, we made a mistake. So because of that cynicism, they never kind of, correct course. And look, shit happens. Mistakes happen. You try something. If it doesn't work, you try something else. They double down and they sort of dig in deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until they can finally kind of somehow get away with it. And nothing ever changes. So there is actually a lot there. Now, the other thing, though, again, my pet topic, nuclear. Look, if you want a low emissions future and, you want your electric cars and you want the lights to stay on, nuclear just makes sense. And there are so many people who agree with me that,
in Wentworth?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. I mean, I've talked to a huge cross section. Like, I've talked to, baby boomers who, they lived through Chernobyl and whatever, and the World War II, and, all the sort of, B movies about, radioactive monsters and whatever. They think it's a good idea. I went to a climate student strike in the city the other day, young people.
Yep.
They don't know much about it because they're sort of learning other stuff in school, but they're not terrified of it. And, yet neither side of politics are talking about it. They think nuclear is the other N-word and it must never be said. And, I mean, it's crazy because, look, I think the Liberal Party could probably win the election tomorrow if they just said, right, we're putting in nuclear power, let's vote on it. But because they're not, all that's happening is we're funneling money from the poor directly to, an entire industry, and that's really problematic as well.
Yeah. So funneling let's go into this climate stuff, because this is what Allegra Spender and everyone's running on, this climate 200, whatever they're called. How is that I know that we've talked about how that message is quite corrupted. They're pretending in a lot of ways. But how much is that message carrying in the electorate? Are people buying it from what you're hearing on the ground?
Well, I mean, again, I think if you went to a person on the street and you just said, do you believe in climate change? They'll all say yes.
Yeah.
If they got to know you a bit better, they might tell you, I think it's a load of bullshit. Or they might tell you that, Australia's total impact on global carbon dioxide emissions is so insignificant that why would we shoot ourselves in the foot multiple times while, China, India, all these other countries power ahead. So there's varying sort of shades of grey, but like so much else in this country, it's been polarised into this kind of binary of you're either for the total abolition of coal and gas, yes, and you want everything powered by, wind and solar at one end, or at the other end, you are a denier and you're denying the science. That's right. And, for me, I think, it actually doesn't matter because, whether you are the biggest sort of, denier and you think climate change is a conspiracy, or whether you are the most, rusted on, true believer in this stuff, we can all agree that, look, let's get rid of, big smokestacks sort of spewing out things and let's just put in nuclear. I mean, one of the real eye-openers for me was when I attended Amanda Mead's campaign launch, which was in rural Melbourne. So she's one of my Victorian Lib Dems colleagues, and as I was driving to her town, I saw this art installation in a big paddock, and what it was all these huge poles, and on top of each of those poles was a Mercedes-Benz logo. And I asked, what's that? And then someone said, it makes more sense when they're spinning, because it was actually a giant wind farm, but the whole thing was just sort of sitting there motionless. And, I got out of the car and I sort of videoed this thing because I thought, this is what happens when the wind doesn't blow. And, we started saying, oh, well, then you'd put in batteries. But I don't like those batteries because of blood cobalt. This is, cobalt, right, that's mined by six-year-old children in Central Africa. But then she told me something that blew me away, which is that I said, how often do these things turn? And she said, well, they're going to have to turn them off at night now because they lost their court case and the noise was keeping people up at late. But apparently when it's really, really windy, they also have to turn them off.
That's right.
And I'm just thinking, if you made a car like that, that like it didn't work half the time, it couldn't drive too quickly and you're only allowed to use it a few hours a day, no one would buy that car. And yet we are falling over ourselves to put this stuff in. And here's the thing. Almost everybody in Wentworth who would be all in favour of wind, the only one they may have seen is if they were driving past Canberra on their way to their chalet at the snow. Those would be the only wind farms they've ever seen. But if you go to this website, stopthesethings.com, I think it is, you just read, the horror stories. And I've seen it firsthand. And that's why, I sort of made the joke that we need windmills for Wentworth, because if these people are to be taken seriously, well, we need windmills in Dover Heights, in Watson's Bay, all around Point Piper, right across Sydney Harbour, because you go to any function now in the city, or even, at private residences, and it always sort of starts with this welcome to country where, we sort of beat our chests and we say, we are on stolen land. And they're literally doing this. These same movements are stealing land from rural landowners, and they're stealing their amenity, and they're stealing their comfort, and they're stealing their ability to sleep at night, because it's so out of sight, out of mind for us. And, I don't think that's right either. And so, it's funny because, I don't want to talk about it too much because I feel I'm probably being, we're giving her the free attention, but Allegra Spender's Core Flutes, her slogan is a better climate for Wentworth. And
yes,
I'd like someone to actually ask her as an election commitment, exactly how much are you going to change the climate in Wentworth in the next 3 years to, you know, to the nearest decimal point?
Do you know why she's saying that, Luca? Is because every poll I've seen for 10 plus years now has shown that people in Wentworth and in similar electorates down here in Melbourne, they're the places that most, as a proportion of the population, want more action on climate change than we're seeing. I don't know how to explain those polls.
Well, maybe it's just because of the polls. I mean, if you went up to these people and you said, well, what's your view on climate change? What's your view on racism? What's your view on the Ukraine? What's your view on child poverty? They're going to give you the approved answer. Now, you know, I mean, Allegra's campaign had a lot of push polling where they was asking very specific questions and you know, they then, you know, would say that this is the number one issue thing. No, it's not. Nobody is sitting around the table every night talking about climate change. No father has ever got in the car and gone for a drive and thought about crashing his car into a pole because of climate change. You know, they're doing it because they can't afford the mortgage or because they've lost their business or because they're ready to get a divorce because they've been homeschooling their kids for the last year because they couldn't go to school or because they're worried about their child's future or they're a young person who thinks they're never going to be able to own a home. So, you know, yeah, they care about climate change, of course. I mean, sure, I mean, I care about world destruction and I care about war and I care about poverty and I care about, you know, xenophobia and I care about refugees and I care about all sorts of things. I do.
Yeah, but it's more there though. So the same polls run in other electorates. It's more predominant. You have a higher percentage of those people concerned about climate change within Wentworth than you do in Kingswood Smith.
Look, you may well, and I mean, I think this might come back to, you know, what was once upon a time, you know, dismissed as you know, the doctor's wives, and these are people who, you know, their struggle is being unable to find a parking spot at Westfield Bondi Junction before their gym class. And I mean, even with polls, you know, I've always sort of wondered who are the people that answer a home landline at 1 p.m. you know, on a school day. So look, I can't really comment. I mean, one thing I do know about polls, you know, the polls said Hillary would win. The poll said Bill Shorten would win. The poll said Brexit wouldn't happen. So I'm a firm believer that there's only one poll that counts and everything else is, you know, at best unreliable or at worst, you know, is push polling that's, you know, being promoted to, you know, to push a particular engine. So look, I don't know. And I like to think I don't just, you know, mix in my own circles. I mean, sure, if, you know, if you're a conservative and you only hang out with other conservatives and, you know, you all sit on the couch late at night watching Sky News together or, you know, you're a green left who, you know, goes out every day to, you know, smash the patriarchy and, you know, fight bosses and whatever. And that's all you hang out with. You know, you sort of create these echo chambers. And I mean, you know, you're getting more and more of it. Like even on dating apps now, you can sort of specify your political leanings so that you will only ever find a person who never challenges your beliefs and whatever. I mean, it's just hopeless. I like to get out there. You know, I mean, look, I went to the climate strike rally, but I'll also go to, you know, rallies at the opposite end of the spectrum just to talk to people and, you know, see what's on their mind. And I want to go back to a place where people can disagree with each other, you know, furiously, but still be friends at the end of it rather than, you know, I mean, look, when I was at this climate strike the other day and, you know, I was there and I had my camera out and I was, you know, shooting some video because I thought this could be interesting. And, you know, I spoke to a bunch of students and it was really fascinating. And, you know, there was a guy there from the Socialist Alternative who was sort of handing out, you know, all sorts of commie stuff. And, you know, I chatted to him and it was very friendly. It was very cool. And then I saw David Shoebridge, who's the Green Senator. And I wandered over to him and I said, hey, you know, do you want to have a chat? And his minders like couldn't get him out of there fast enough. And, and he said, well, no, I don't really want to talk to you. And I said, why not? He said, because you're a climate denier. And I said, you don't know me. How do you know what I am? He says, well, you know, because he could see someone with me had a Lib Dems t-shirt. He says, well, the Lib Dems are climate deniers. And that's actually not correct. I mean, if you visit the website, there's nothing particularly there. Most of the Lib Dems who I've spoken to, look, they're perfectly fine, you know, with the science. I mean, I love that term. But you know, the question for them is, well, do we need to do anything about it? And if so, you know, what do we do? But I was just astonished that this guy, who is like a professional, you know, politician, a speaker, a debater, was so willing to sort of shut someone down as you know, the unacceptable. I mean, anytime I hear denier, it sounds like Holocaust denier. It's a huge smear. It's not okay. And, you know, I wasn't like some YouTuber that was trying to, you know, humiliate him. You know, I was perfectly happy just to have a chat like you and I are. And he could have educated me. He could have told me something I didn't know, but he was not interested in that. And, you know, I don't like that. I think you've actually got to read the newspapers that you hate. You know, if you're a subscriber to The Australian, you actually need to read the Sydney Morning Herald or even The Guardian sometimes, you know, and vice versa. If you don't do that, you just become shoutier and shoutier and you know, we'll just get angry. And I don't think that's a good way to be in a marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. They don't like to debate. They like to indoctrinate their own views. And if you challenge them, that's not how they like to play with their ideas.
But there's no block button in real life, which is, you know, which is a problem because, you know, if you actually start talking to someone at a pub, you know, they can't just kind of, you know, do that and never hear from you again.
Hey, before we go, we should talk about the ghost, as Sky News likes to call him, Malcolm Turnbull, in your electorate. I'm wondering what's going on with him lately. He's been coming out encouraging people, basically encouraging them to vote for Teal, for independence against them. Funny story, I followed Malcolm Turnbull home once.
Wow, that doesn't sound creepy at all.
You know? I'm probably on an ASIO list now for saying this publicly. No, because I lived in the area. I lived in Vaucluse as well. And I was driving home and I thought, gee, that looks very fancy. I wonder what, there's a motorcade and had all the flat, the C number plate and everything.
So that wasn't the one where he would catch the public bus, but there was a chase car behind the bus.
No, I saw this car. I thought, who's in that car? I'm on my way home. And I at a light, so I saw, oh my goodness, that's Malcolm Turnbull sitting in the back seat. So I just kept driving along and happened to be on the same street. And I saw him pull into his house and I saw where he lives. And I thought, man, that's... Interesting kind of left turn he's taken the Liberal Party. This is when he was Prime Minister. And now you see him coming out swinging against the Liberal Party. Are you hearing anyone talking about Malcolm in the electorate? Because I know that around the country he's a little bit mocked, a little bit or a lot. I'm wondering if in Wentworth he's still quite popular. Because when he was in, the margin for Liberals was higher. And then when he left politics, the margin came back to a normal historical average.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's very easy to sort of Monday morning quarterback this sort of stuff. And, you know, some people would say that, you know, the swing to Karen Phelps was maybe it was because there were people who were protective of Malcolm, or maybe it was because people, and I know I'm one, who were really not happy with this new Australian sport of changing prime ministers. You know, all the time. So, you know, there could be many reasons for that. One thing that I think surprises me is that, I mean, I know because it's been explained to me exactly what would get me disendorsed from my party. You know, if I said that I support increasing a tax or a new tax, the Lib Dems would disendorse me. You know, they're very laid back about other things. You know, I can say far out things there, and you know, they're okay with that. And you know, we can disagree on other things. And you know, there are some people who are, you know, I don't know, they might have a particular view on, say, abortion, and there's other people who might have a different view or things like that. You know, we're a fairly broad church in that regard. But you know, you raise the tax, and that's a showstopper for most people, because we really are a party that is firmly committed to lower taxes. Now, the Liberal Party and the Labor Party also have, you know, their own sets of rules. For example, in the Labor Party, if you vote against the party line, you cross the floor. That's grounds for automatic expulsion. So it's kind of, you know, it's funny sort of seeing all these Labor people crowing about Dave Sharma crossing the floor without appreciating that, you know, so, you know, you'd have your Penny Wongs saying she doesn't, you know, support particular gay rights and things like that, just because, you know, she probably would have had a huge internal conflict with that, but that's the way, you know, those sort of parties work. But I think surely Malcolm would have crossed enough red lines that you sort of wonder you know, is there actually anybody in the party who has the balls to deal with this?
No.
And, you know, I mean, look, there's a lot of people saying that if the Liberals were smart, they'd write off Wentworth and they'd go and campaign out west where you have business owners, small business owners, people who are aspirational, people who want a future for their kids. And, you know, they could leave Wentworth to, you know, to the Greens. Or Labor and just kind of get it. I don't think they do that because they still have some extremely large donors in Wentworth. And you know what? It may be the case that Malcolm is still a donor. I mean, maybe he donates to all of them. You know, I'm not going to tell someone how to spend their own hard-earned. I can't comment on that. What I can say is I was disappointed that he was in, I think it was New York the other day when he made those comments, because I went to all the trouble of hanging one of my awesome call flutes right out the front of his house. And I don't know if he's had a chance to see it or not.
Well done. So you're stalking him as well. ASIO, take notes, not just me.
I don't like to think of it as stalking. I think it's more just meeting the electorate.
I thought his house would have been nicer, to be frank. Sorry, Malcolm. Hey, before we go, actually, we'll go to just some quick policy. There's only really one policy item I'd love to you to explain to everyone, and I think you'll be able to do it quite well, and that's flat tax. So people kind of buy this narrative from the majors over the past 50 years. It's not fair. We're going to make it fairer. The big end of town. It's not just Labor that do this, you know, but it's this progressive tax system has become such a thing you can't touch, sacred thing in Australia. And so for someone to come out and suggest a flat tax seems anathema to our way of life. So here's your opportunity to do a couple of minutes and explain to us and sell us on why a flat tax is so good and is actually quite socially progressive and good. It's not about making the rich richer. Please go ahead.
So what I'll do then is I'll just explain what I think is the problem. And then we've actually cut together this fantastic video and we'll just throw to that so that people can see it for themselves.
Am I allowed to do that?
Oh, we'd love you to do that, Matt.
All right. We'll throw that in the end of the interview. Yep.
Sorry. Fantastic. So look, the problem that we have in this country is that the government is elected and campaigns are run on the basis of candidates saying how much they're going to give voters. So we have all this pork and, you know, the Labor Party says, well, we're going to give, you know, $1,000 subsidies for this. And then the Liberal Party say, well, we're going to put $250 a week there. That money comes from somewhere. You know, and what we don't have is government, rather than saying this is how much we're going to give you, we don't have government saying this is how we're going to let you keep your money, and of the small amount of money that we take, this is how we're going to look after it. Most Australians don't realise that they're not paying 30% tax, you know, because that's what they see on their pay slip. They're paying, you know, 50 to 60% of every dollar they earn goes elsewhere in tax, whether it's GST, whether it's PAYG, whether it's fuel excise tax, whether it's tax on booze, on food, you know, electricity, everything, you know. So people aren't keeping it. And okay, fine, we could have a high tax country, and you know, yes, we can have lots of welfare and things like that. But what we also have in this country is this system that mandates what people get paid for a particular job. So if you're a nurse, you'll get paid this. If you're a teacher, you'll get paid that. And so when the wages are very fixed and people don't have a lot of money, but then suddenly costs go up, everything kind of falls apart. And the worst problem with this sort of churning of the tax, where the government takes all this tax and then, you know, generously gives it back to people, is that so much of these subsidies and this middle-class welfare is nothing more than the government cleaning up a mess it made itself. So the one that you hear about in Wentworth all the time, because we have young families, multiple children, and sort of double income families, is childcare. And people are sort of talking about the high cost of childcare and they want to know about subsidies. And they realize that subsidies are not the solution. They're actually the problem. I mean, if you were a mother who had three children and 12 grandchildren, right, all of whom are successful, right? You are not qualified to run a daycare. You're not. Yes. You've raised all those children and grandchildren, but you are not qualified. Whereas a 19-year-old who has no children but has done something called a Certificate 3 in early childhood education is qualified. Now, that is a 12-month course that includes, you know, modules with really, really fancy names, but are literally how to wipe a kid's bum, how to wipe a kid's nose, how to stop a kid getting backed over in the car park, right? Now, when they introduce that sort of course and that training and that red tape, the costs go up. So you've not only got high labor costs, because rather than getting an old pensioner who wants to work for a few hours and, you know, she raised all her children and now she wants to raise them, can't do that. We don't have a village to raise a child. We have a corporation to raise a child. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. And then the costs go up. And so then all of a sudden now, you know, it genuinely costs someone $100 a day just to run that daycare center per kid. So they might charge, you know, $150, $200. So they actually make a bit of a margin. Now, all of a sudden, people can't afford that. So the government goes, well, I tell you what, we're going to give everybody $90 a day subsidy toward daycare. Guess what the owner of the daycare center is going to do? They're going to jack up their rates to absorb that new subsidy. Now, we propose an alternative approach, which is just less government. You know, okay, yes, the government should absolutely be making sure that these places are safe and they're not death traps. And yes, we should be making sure that you don't have pedophiles working in childcare facilities and that, you know, kids aren't going to get generally harmed. But we don't need a 12-month course called early childhood education when the most educational aspect of it is literally reading them a bedtime story. So the government creates the problem and then it tries to solve it with subsidies, but those subsidies come from tax. And one of the things, you know, if anyone's got time to read a 300-odd page report that the Australian Taxpayer Alliance wrote, I mean, this would blow your mind. And the greatest thing about it is that if you significantly lower the tax rate, the overall revenue from tax can go up. And I'll give you an example of that. If we had, you hear about people saying, oh, multinationals aren't paying, you know, their fair tax because, I don't know, Apple, for example, you know, they base their sort of tax activities in Ireland. Well, if we lowered our tax down to the point where companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft would actually call Australia home, it could potentially make, you know, mining, which is our big sort of tax windfall at the moment, you know, almost become irrelevant. But instead, we seem to have this idea where we're just going to leave everything. And then, of course, you get these ridiculous policies from the Greens saying, oh, well, we're going to tax billionaires because apparently billionaires don't have accountants and the ability to, you know, it's just so ridiculous.
This is called the Laffer curve, right? So the Laffer tax curve, is that it? The right one where your maximum tax revenue does not come from the maximum rate. It comes from a place in the middle somewhere because you have a higher volume at a lower rate.
Exactly right. And it also drives investment. I mean, right now, you know, who would think of starting a business? Why would you look at starting a business now when, you know, potentially the government could shut you down, you know, tomorrow, or there's so much red tape, there's so much tax, you know, why would you bother? I mean, I always laugh, you know, I own a security business and, you know, I say I could be a complete screw up in America and make so much more money than being a complete success in this country. Now, you know, I stay here because it's a nice place, but we're not attracting, you know, that sort of investment. And, you know, I mean, you look at some of our sort of, you know, billionaires here, you know, your Mike Cannon Brookses and so forth, who are trying to sort of, you know, engineer the way the rest of us are going to live. But, you know, their activities are offshore and so forth as well for exactly this reason. Now, what if we could turn that around and we could suddenly make Australia attractive the way, for example, once upon a time, you know, Hong Kong was, or certain areas in America were? The overall revenue goes up, the jobs go up, the amenity goes up. But instead, we're sort of stuck in this 1950s paradigm where, well, we're going to have, you know, more wages for workers. And they don't understand that, hang on, if productivity doesn't go up, all you're doing is you're making it harder and harder for businesses. So you wonder why we have no manufacturing industry, why we have, you know, none of the old jobs here. So, you know, anytime you hear a Labor politician get up and say, oh, we're going to bring back manufacturing. No, you're not. I mean, no one is going to want to pay, you know, $600 for something when they can buy the same thing for $5, you know, off a boat from China. I mean, we created China and we're not creating the solution. We could be doing that in the South Pacific. One of the things that I'd like to do is I would like to plonk a giant Las Vegas right in the middle of Central Australia so that we could lift our population. We could bring over a big workforce. We could create jobs. We could create all sorts of opportunity in Central Australia for underprivileged communities. In order to do that, we'd have to create a special administrative region there where, you know, we didn't have the award wages and we didn't have the tax. And for the first 20 years, we could just kind of build things. And if we wanted foreign workers to come over and get paid at, you know, Thailand rates or Philippine rates, and they're very, very happy to do that, we let that happen here.
Little Hong Kong, yeah. Little bastion of freedom.
But in this country, it won't happen because we'll have all these people who go, we can't have that. So instead, we'll have nothing. And, you know, we sort of kill the patient to save it, which is what we keep doing. So, you know, the end result of that is, I mean, what I just said is what would probably once be called, you know, a visionary idea, like, you know, a Harbour Bridge or a Snowy Hydro scheme. And instead, we have politicians who can only think as far as the next election. And, you know, the next election is only a few years away every time.
Yeah, how does this get us to the flat tax? So that's the problem. It's messed up, childcare and so on.
So the problem with our tax system is twofold. First of all, it's just too high. We pay too much tax, and there's a lot of double dipping as well because, recently, you know, fuel prices have been through the roof, and it's very easy for the government to, you know, blame that on the conflict in Ukraine. And, you know, they sort of suggested some relief in the form of we're gonna reduce temporarily the fuel excise tax. Well, we say, well, why don't you just scrap that altogether? Because what people don't realize is not only are they charging the excise tax, so the company that, you know, sells the fuel, they have to pay a tax on that. They're also taxing the oil refinery. They're taxing the petrol station. They're taxing the employee who works in the petrol station. They're taxing you. They're charging you on the GST. So there's all this like double, triple, quadruple dipping of tax every stage of the way. And all of this tax is index. So it actually goes up and up and up and up every year, and no one knows about it. So you've never had any sort of political campaign where they've said they're going to raise taxes, and yet the taxes actually go up, and it's all sort of done by stealth. We want to get rid of that. The other problem, as well as being too high, is that it's too complicated. You know, people don't understand bracket creep. They don't understand how, you know, that pay rise that they're really excited about is suddenly going to actually hurt them more than had they never had the pay rise. We also have the discrepancy between personal income tax and company tax. So, you have a lot of, I see it in my industry all the time. You get people who, you know, there's fairly low barriers to entry into the security industry. So you might have a person who's, you know, a security guard on a Friday and they become a company director on Monday. And, if their boss used to pay them $15 an hour and he charged the client $20 an hour, then according to their year 9 business studies, they were making $5 per hour profit. And that's what they think. So they then go and start their own company. But now they'll pay the guard $15 an hour, but they'll charge the client $19 an hour. So they'll win all the work and they're still making $4 an hour profit. Now, they think that. In reality, the award wage is probably over $17 and the guy he used to work for was breaking the law and he's breaking the law. And they're not dishonest people. They're just sort of clueless. But the favorite thing is that they all get this idea that you put everything through the business and it's all tax-free. So, you know, you get, caravans with the word security written on the side of it, or fishing boats that have the word security written on the side of it because they call it, oh, that's their patrol boat or that's their surveillance caravan, whatever. And look, they'll get away with it because the ATO will probably never catch up with them. But they're trying to do that. Now, if we just sort of bring the company tax down, which promotes investment, it brings money into the system, but we also bring the personal tax down. So there's no advantage to try and sort of, you know, rort things one way or the other. It's just lower and easier for everyone. And it's very easy to understand. It works. But, you know, perhaps let's just wrap this up and show the video because it does a really good job of explaining it. And it's quite radical and it's something that people need to think of because the main thing is people don't appreciate not only how much they're actually paying in tax, but also how much the government wastes. And, you know, that just needs to stop.
So can I ask, before we go to the video, though, how do you fund the country? Let's say it's a flat tax of 20% or whatever you're proposing. at the moment, we know that the top end of town, the big earners are the big taxpayers actually carrying the tax burden for all of us, for the rest of us.
Can I just say, it's funny you say that, because the biggest, you know, advocates for renewables and so forth, propagate this myth that, you know, there's fossil fuel subsidies in this country and mining subsidies in this country. And they don't appreciate that mining subsidizes the country, not the other way around. I mean, the revenues that are coming out of that are what's paying for the hospitals and the schools and the roads. And you have all these people who want to sort of turn that off because it makes their paymasters wealthy, but it's shooting us in the foot. So look, that tax revenue is not necessarily going to all of a sudden, you know, dry up. And I don't expect that.
Well, it will if you reduce even the personal tax rates from 46 down to 20.
It's not going to happen over time. I mean, obviously you have to progress these things. I mean, if you're going to have any sort of radical change, you can't do it too quickly. You would have to phase it in. And, you know, listen, let's face it. I think the Lib Dems need to obtain a bit more power in Parliament. And look, quite honestly, you know, if you had a Liberal government, or even a Labor government that ever sort of looked at doing something radical, then, you know, maybe we wouldn't even need to exist and we wouldn't need to be talking about these things. But, you know, we are talking about it because at the moment we just have this sort of constant cycle of, well, let's spend the money. Oh, where are we going to get the money from? Let's get it from taxes. And, you know, round and round and round it goes. We have to look at a smarter way of doing it. And, you know, as you referred to it before, if you can actually make the tax lower, there's actually going to be a very, very quick uptake of investment and new capital coming into this country. So, you know, there's not going to be this sort of sudden drop that we're going to really have to crawl our way back in. As long as we kind of, you know, progressively manage the change, I think we can actually do it in a really sensible way that over the long term will help all of us. I mean, look, I think it's extreme and I can't imagine it ever really happening, but, you know, it would be possible that we could have nuclear energy here because we're so rich with that in this country that no one would ever have to pay an electricity bill again. And, you know, we'd end up like the Jetsons and we're all sort of zooming around in our electric cars and we're not paying for things. I mean, look, that's a long way off. I think at the moment we've just got too many people who are just too good at spending other people's money, and I wish they'd stop spending mine.
So, all right, well then let's maybe if I try and get a summary question answer. Are you telling me that with a flat tax, it's possible to still run society, run government a whole lot better, going to shrink it and so on? But you're telling me that it's mathematically possible, because in my head, it does not work if you reduce the tax rates to a flat 20 or whatever.
So a couple of things. I mean, you only touched on it briefly, but I mean, getting rid of the waste is a huge part of that, because a lot of the, you know, the tax that gets collected at the moment is just to kind of go to, you know, the dead hand of government that's sitting on everything. I mean, you know, there are some classic examples. The Federal Department of Education that's got, you know, thousands of staff and millions or billions of budget and exactly zero schools. And, you know, same with, you know, federal health departments that don't have a single nurse working for them and the multiple layers of government. So there is tremendous efficiency that needs to happen there. And, you know, part of the problem also is that, you know, when you have particularly Labor in, you know, the public service grows and grows and grows and grows. And when you have public servants who are on $500,000-$700,000 salaries, they're never ever going to vote for someone whose election promise is to shrink government. So, you know, that kind of becomes this unstoppable force. You might have a Liberal government that traditionally sort of shrinks the public service, but it's not drastic enough. And the Liberal government now and the Labor Party becoming harder and harder to discern. So it's important not to just kind of brush over that. It's critical that we get rid of the waste and we get rid of the bloat, because that suddenly means we already need less tax. Another good example that comes up a lot at the moment is the NDIS, because, you know, nobody wants to see people with disabilities impacted or to go without. But it's also true that the NDIS has become this incredibly bloated bureaucracy. And it's also true that, you know, as is the case whenever the government create a huge trough of money, all of the pigs get their snouts into that trough. And, you know, look, I can tell you through some of the work that I do that there has been absolute rorting going on, you know, within the NDIS. Now, the problem is that we, again, because we don't have politicians who are able to clearly articulate a case, if a politician got up and said, look, there's $35 million worth of rorting that happened in just, you know, in the last X period of time, and we want to put in controls that are going to stop that happening, and we've straight away saved $35 million. No one could possibly disagree with that, but they're not even prepared to say that because that would be admitting that a system's not working. So every now and then, maybe you'll get, you know, a current affair or some media outlet that will show the rorting and show the fraud. But the government, if they were to turn up and say, well, we're going to pull, you know, I don't know, I'm just making up figures here, but we're going to pull $100 million out of the NDIS because that figure just so happens to be nothing but fraud, right? That should be the easiest $100 million to get rid of. But instead, you'll then get an opposition who turn up the next day with a whole lot of kids in wheelchairs holding up signs saying, don't defund the NDIS, rather than realizing that those kids are actually suffering because of that, you know, rorting and so on going through it. So look, you can do this as a sort of, you know, ladder ratchet exercise, you know, reduce the waste, reduce the tax, reduce the waste further, reduce that. You know, if you did something radical overnight, it's going to collapse in heat. But look, you know, bureaucracy and politics and things, it is a slow moving beast. So even though the policy itself seems quite radical, there's no reason that the implementation of it should be radical. So, I mean, I understand your concern, and your concern is, but hang on, if we do this, everything's going to, you know, fall in a heap. That's only going to happen, you know, if suddenly overnight, you know, there's total anarchy and, you know, all the rules just stop. That's not going to happen, or at least, you know, not in any sort of government that I would want to be part of.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Daniel, and best of luck in the polls in 2 weeks' time.
Matt, thanks so much, and really love your show as well.
Okay, to Cernobillions, that was Daniel Lukovits. Luko, you'll see his awesome core flutes all about in the Wentworth electorate. We need to go and get some pictures of those because I don't think they'll be repeated. If you like this episode, go ahead and grab the URL and the address bar at the top, share it with people, put it on your social, say, hey, here's some rational discussion coming out of the electorate of Wentworth. Let's finish right now with the video that we talked about. We're going to show you this from the LDP. I haven't actually seen it yet, so I'm going to be seeing it all with you right now. Have a good day.
We will flatten the curve of taxation. Don't watch this video if you think it's okay to have your tax dollars pay the Prime Minister a salary higher than the President of the United States.
Come on, man.
Don't watch this if you like paying a company tax well above the OECD average. And don't watch this if you love to stifle progress by taking money from small businesses and giving it to the government to waste. Hi, I'm David Limbrick, a Member of Parliament for the Liberal Democrats here in Victoria. And I want to cut taxes because the government has taken enough from you already. In this video, I want to talk to you about the fourth policy in the Liberal Democrats' Freedom Manifesto, low, flat taxes. Australia has one of the highest company tax rates in the world. And we spend those tax dollars on the stupidest things imaginable, like corporate welfare and subsidies. The OECD company tax rate is 23%. Australia sits at 30%. The Liberal Democrats want to bring this down to a flat rate of 20% across the board. If you're making less than $40,000, you'll pay zero tax. A flat tax simplifies and makes the economy more efficient and dynamic. By lowering company tax rates to a competitive level, will attract better businesses and investors to Australia. No longer will our best and brightest jump ship and set up successful businesses in countries with better incentives. We can keep our entrepreneurs here. The reality is that with a lower tax rate, businesses grow and prosper. Think about this. If a business with $100 million profit gets a tax cut to 20%, that business would now have an extra $10 million to open new stores, develop new products, and employ more staff. That means jobs for you and your family and better products and services for us all. In the long term, this policy will mean that businesses can employ more staff, pay higher wages, and they can stop wasting time and resources on clever ways to minimise their tax. If you want an Australia of low tax and high opportunity, then vote Liberal Democrats. To learn more, head to our website, www.ldp.org.au.
Authorised by John Humphreys for the Liberal Democratic Party, Mount Waverley, Victoria.